So I was previously a student of Susan Pasquitz's when I was at the University of Wisconsin. I was an undergraduate in the entomology program, and I took her medical entomology course and got interested in doing research. And she gave me my first opportunity as an undergraduate to conduct research in an actual research lab. And so when I was trying to figure out how to organize my talk, I decided to showcase a couple projects that are going on in my lab from undergraduates that are doing research at the University of Arizona. And U of A has a number of very nice programs for undergraduate researchers, the biggest one of which is an undergraduate biology research program, or UBERP. And so it's just really nice to see the opportunities that undergraduates have doing research similar to the opportunity Susan gave me. So just to give you an idea of what we're working on in the lab, we're interested in manipulating the mosquito's lifespan in order to reduce vector competence. And the most common way for controlling mosquito-borne diseases throughout the world now is shown here. And you have insecticide treatments of bed nets or the insecticide treatment of interiors of buildings for residual spraying and whatnot. But the problem with this is when you kill off the mosquitoes like this, it leaves an ecological void. And as soon as the control measures are stopped, once money runs out for the programs, or once insecticide resistance develops, the mosquitoes will quickly refill that niche, and you'll have a problem just as bad as you had before, if not even worse. And so what some people are trying to do is to actually figure out alternative ways of preventing parasites from being transmitted through the mosquito itself. And the primary way people are trying to do this is to actually kill the parasite within the mosquito. So there's a number of labs throughout the world that are coming up with anti-malarial molecules or RNAi strategies to combat dengue. And this is a perfectly viable approach. But there is other possibilities, and what our lab is working on is to actually shorten the mosquito's lifespan so that the parasites don't have time to actually develop within the mosquito. And this is possible because a lot of mosquito-borne diseases actually have very long development times within the mosquito host. For example, malaria under fairly ideal conditions will take anywhere from 10 to 14 days from the time the mosquito takes its first blood meal and gets infected to the time where it can transmit those parasites onto another vertebrate host. West Nile virus, anywhere 10 to 12 days. Filariasis, 10 to 14 days. Dengue virus and dengue hemorrhagic fever, 8 to 12 days. So this is a fairly long obligate developmental period within the mosquito that we can exploit. If we can get the mosquito's lifespan from its average of about 20 days down to an average of about 14 to 16 days, we can have a really significant impact on disease transmission. So then the question, of course, is how do you actually go about manipulating lifespan? Well, there's been a lot of work done on insulin signaling, both in insects, in worms, in mice, and in all of these organisms, insulin signaling plays a very critical role in regulating lifespan. So this is the insulin signaling cascade right here. It's not as bad as it looks. You start with an insulin-like peptide that binds to the receptor, and this occurs extracellularly. Once the insulin-like peptide binds, it actually transduces the signal across the cell membrane, activating the beta subunit of the insulin receptor. This activates insulin receptor substrate 1, and that provides a docking site for a number of different signaling cascades in the insulin pathway. One of these is the MAP kinase cascade, which I'm not going to go into any detail on, as it doesn't have any role in lifespan or reproduction in most organisms. And then the other cascade is the PI3 kinase cascade, which I'll be talking about today. So PI3 kinase consists of two subunits, a P85 regulatory subunit and a P110 catalytic subunit. The regulatory subunit binds to IRS1, and that frees up the catalytic subunit to travel to the cell membrane and phosphorylate phosphatidylinositol 4-5 on the third position, creating PI345. PI345 provides a binding site for downstream signaling components such as AKT and PDK1. PDK1 can phosphorylate and activate AKT, which in turn can activate inactivate forkhead transcription factors via phosphorylation. Now there's another component to this cascade on here, and that's P10. And P10 is actually a direct antagonist of PI3 kinase. And so it actually inhibits the insulin signaling cascade. So P10 removes that phosphate from the third position of PI345, converting it back into PI45. So PI3 kinase and P10 pretty much battle each other for control of the insulin signaling cascade. And so the first project that the undergraduates in my lab have worked on is this project, which looks at the interplay between PI3 kinase and P10 in the mosquito. And this was done, the PI3 kinase work was done by Ben Bertal, and the P10 work was done, at least in part, by a second undergraduate student, Anam Javad, who's currently moved on to become my graduate student. Okay, so we'll look at PI3 kinase first. As I said, PI3 kinase consists of two subunits, the regulatory P85 subunit and the catalytic P110 subunit. We looked at the expression pattern of the catalytic P110 subunit in a variety of adult female tissues and found that it was most abundant far and away in the ovary. But it was found in all the other tissues, as you would expect the signaling molecule to be. So it's found in the head, it's found in the fat body, it's found in the midgut. But this is only transcript expression, and this really doesn't tell the story. What you really need to know is there an impact, or where is the protein actually being expressed, since that's what actually does the signaling. So we generated antibodies against the P110 subunit and pretty much saw the same results with the antibody. P110 was most abundant in the ovaries, but you could also find it in the head, in the abdominal body wall, in the fat body. We could routinely find it in the midgut too, although it's not shown on this immunoblot. We never found it in the thorax, again consistent with the transcript data. But since it was most abundant in the ovaries, we went ahead and wanted to see what was actually going on during a reproductive cycle. What goes on when the mosquito actually takes a blood meal? And so we dissected ovaries out from different time points after the blood meal. So NBF is non-blood fed, it's prior to taking the meal. And you can see that the protein is present for about the first 12 to 24 hours. We'd sometimes see it at 24 hours, sometimes we wouldn't. But then it disappears from about 24 to 48 hours, and then it comes back at 72 hours after oviposition occurs. And this actually makes a lot of sense. So what we think is going on is the role of the follicle cells surrounding the individual primary follicle is to produce ecdysteroids. And these ecdysteroids that are produced then travel to the fat body, stimulating yolk protein synthesis that is then taken up into the egg. Well, this occurs during the first 18 to 24 hours or so. After that time, the role of the follicle cells switch from steroid production to chorion production. And the insulin signaling cascade has no role in eggshell production whatsoever, so the molecules aren't needed and they're degraded. So the molecules appear to be present when steroid production is going on, and insulin signaling plays a critical role in steroid production, and then disappears at the later time points. Then after oviposition, once the secondary follicle has matured into a new primary follicle, the protein returns and the mosquito is ready to take its next blood meal. And this is exactly what we saw with another signaling molecule, the insulin receptor itself, where it disappeared from 24 to 48 hours when steroid production wasn't occurring. Now this is actually some old data. This wasn't performed by the undergraduate students, but this is just to demonstrate that PI3 kinase and the insulin signaling cascade as a whole is involved in this steroid production in the ovary. So we did this in vitro ecdysteroid assay. We dissected out ovaries and incubated them in saline solution, and then we stimulated them with bovine insulin and used various inhibitors to shut it off. And so when we used two different inhibitors of PI3 kinase, the natural fungal metabolite wartmannin or the synthetic compound LY294002, both of them were able to pretty much shut down steroid production in the ovaries when we used them, indicating that insulin signaling is critical for steroidogenesis. The other thing I talked about briefly during the signaling cascade is how the P110 subunit, the catalytic subunit, actually translocates from the cytoplasm to the cell membrane. So it travels, once it's activated, it travels to the cell membrane to phosphorylate PI45 into PI345. And so Ben used the antibody that we generated to perform immunocytochemistry and see what's happening when the ovaries are stimulated with insulin. And this is just to orient you. This is the primary follicle here, and it's surrounded by these follicular epithelial cells. And that's what we're looking at here. We just took a section right across the surface of the follicle, and you're looking at these follicular epithelial cells. When you have membrane staining, like you do with the insulin receptor, which is actually membrane-bound, you have this very nice outline of each of the individual follicle cells. When you have a cytoplasmic protein, such as PI3 kinase, you can still make out the individual nuclei, but you can't see the individual cell walls of the follicle cells. So when we actually stimulate the ovaries with bovine insulin, you can see prior to stimulation, you basically have completely cytoplasmic staining. But within 15 seconds of stimulating with bovine insulin, you get this nice outline of the individual follicle cells that you can see on this over here and then blown up down below. And this is consistent pretty much for the first 2 minutes as far as we went out. Actually, we went out to about 15 minutes, but the ovaries were in a bad shape at that point. So clearly we do have this movement of P110 from the cytoplasm to the cell membrane where it's presumably activating PI345. Okay, so moving on to the antagonist of PI3 kinase, we have P10. And this is work done by Anam in my lab, primarily. And this was supposed to be a nice, simple project for her to work on, but as so often happens, we ended up finding a whole bunch of splice variants for this supposedly simple phosphatase. And we actually have two different categories of splice variants. We have three of them that occur through intron retention. And what intron retention is basically instead of the transcript being spliced correctly at the intron, the transcription just occurs through the splice site, a stop codon is quickly run into, and you end up with these truncated forms. And that happened with P10-5 here, P10-4 here, and P10-1 here. The other three splice variants occur through alternative splicing of the last exon. So we get to this last exon here, and we get three different splice variants due to differences in this last exon, right at the C-terminus. So you have one that's generated by just splicing out a 64 base pair intron, one a 25,000 base pair intron, and the third a 37,000 base pair intron. So the three that occur through, you know, errors in intron splicing and through intron retention, they're probably not that interesting. They don't encode the carboxy terminal tail, and this tail is really critical for protein stability. So even if the protein's made, it probably degrades very quickly. But the three that occur through this alternative splicing of the last exon are very interesting. So we looked at the transcription of these various things using both quantitative real-time PCR and RT-PCR, which is shown here. And you can see that the ones that occur through intron retention, they're in white down here, you have 1, 4, and 5, they're pretty much present in every tissue at fairly low levels. But again, we don't think these play a very critical role because the proteins are probably degraded very, very quickly. In contrast, the ones that occur through alternative splicing of that last exon have a very unique pattern, both in immature stages and in the adults. So in the adults, P10-2, it's only found in the ovary. It's not found in any other developmental stage. It's strictly ovary-specific. P10-3, in contrast, very abundant in the head, also fairly abundant in the midgut. You can find some in the thorax and abdomen as well, but predominantly in the head and the midgut. P10-6, in contrast, is present in the reproductive tissues. You can find it in the ovaries. This is a bad example, but we do find it consistently in the fat body as well. We find a little bit in the head. We generally don't see transcript in the midgut, though. So it's a very different expression pattern from P10-3. Also, in the immature stages, P10-3 is abundant late in embryogenesis and throughout larval and pupal development, whereas P10-6 is dominant in early embryogenesis, those first 6 to 12 hours after oviposition, but I'm not showing that here. We also checked to see whether all these splice variants were active phosphatases. This is a fairly simple in vitro assay, and we just look at whether the recombinant protein can, when incubated with PI345, can actually remove that phosphate, and then we detect the free phosphates in there with malachite green. And in fact, not surprisingly, since they all encode the complete phosphatase domain, all 6 of the splice variants were able to have phosphatase activity. So recently we've developed a couple of splice variant specific antibodies against that C-terminal tail. We made antibodies against P10-3 and P10-6, the ones that have the unique expression patterns in the immature stages and in the adults. And we have some preliminary evidence with P10-3, which I haven't shown up here. We were having problems with it, but we have it affinity purified now. And it looks like P10-3 is expressed exclusively in the head and the midgut, which is fairly consistent with the transcript data. P10-6, on the other hand, the protein's everywhere. Even the midgut, where we didn't see any transcript, we have plenty of protein available for P10-6. So we're not sure if the transcript's just very short-lived in the midgut and we were missing it, or what's going on. But we knew it was in the ovary, so again, we did our usual post-blood meal test, just like we did with the insulin receptor in P110. And we see a very similar thing. It's present during the first 12 hours, and then once the ovary switch from steroid production to eggshell production, it's lost. We also have this other event that we've seen about 70% of the time, where we see this very minor size shift down at the 12, and when we see it at 24 hours at 24. We're not 100% sure what that is, but we think that has to do with the phosphorylation state. When P10 is phosphorylated, it's actually inactive. And during these early time points, you would want it inactive so that the insulin signaling could occur. So it's possible at these late time points, it's getting dephosphorylated and activated, and that's why we're seeing this shy shift down. Again, very consistent with the expression patterns in the ovary we saw with P110 and the insulin receptor. And then in the fat body, we see it all the time. So we don't see this change in the fat body. It's just there at fairly constant levels throughout the reproductive cycle. And then finally, we did RNAi with P10, and we either injected double-stranded RNA against P10 or as a control against DS-RED. And we allowed the mosquitoes to recover for 2 days and then gave them a blood meal and looked at either 24 or 48 hours after a blood meal to see what was going on with reproduction. Now, this is not splice variant specific. This was to the phosphatase domain, so it'll knock out any P10 in the mosquito. And what we saw is, you can see pretty clearly here at 24 hours, the ovaries are much more developed in the ones we knocked out the P10 in compared to the controls. This is pretty much normal development, and these guys are much farther along. And when we looked at 48 hours and actually counted the follicles and looked at how many follicles were produced, we found that it wasn't so much a size issue. We saw a slight increase in the follicle size, the amount of yolk that's been deposited in there, in the P10, but it wasn't really significant. However, there was a very marked increase in the number of follicles that were actually maturing. So in the controls, we had about 75 follicles that had matured and taken up yolk, whereas in the P10 mosquitoes, we had about 105 to 110 being produced. So this suggests that fewer of the follicles are being resorbed, and they're all going on to produce mature eggs. Okay, so the second project that I'll go through fairly quickly is a project that we're actually collaborating with Shirley Luckhart at UC Davis on and with Mark Brown at Georgia. And my undergraduate student, Laurel Watkins, is the main researcher on this project. And the idea here is that when a mosquito takes a blood meal from a vertebrate, they're actually picking up a fairly large dose of both insulin and insulin growth factor from the blood meal itself. And Shirley was able to demonstrate that just feeding the mosquitoes human insulin was enough to actually stimulate the insulin signaling cascade in the mosquito's midgut. And so she went on and wanted to look at what effect feeding human insulin actually had on lifespan. And so she fed them either a physiological concentration of human insulin, kind of on the high end of physiological, but 10 to the minus 3 micromolar, or buffer only in an artificial blood meal. And those mosquitoes that were given human insulin actually had a marked decrease in their lifespan. The average lifespan is somewhere around 20 days, and you have a decrease here of about 4 to 5 days throughout the entire lifespan. And so this is pretty significant decrease in lifespan when you're thinking about the mosquito's average lifespan is really only about 21 days in the field. And she replicated this about 5 times and had similar results. They weren't significant. The first 2 experiments weren't significant because she had a very small sample size, but when she increased her sample size, it became significant. So what we're trying to do in the lab and what Laurel's working on is to actually generate transgenic mosquitoes that specifically activate the insulin signaling cascade in the midgut to kind of mimic what's happening when the mosquito's taking a blood meal. And so she generated 2 constructs, one that results in the expression and the activation of insulin signaling called MIR and Offley-Stevens-I AKT, and then another one that would inhibit the insulin signaling cascade, which is an Offley-Stevens-I P10. These are both driven by the carboxypeptidase promoter, which is a blood meal specific and midgut specific promoter. So the carboxypeptidase genes, or genes controlled by carboxypeptidase, should only be expressed following a blood meal in the midgut. And we use a different fluorescent marker for each one, DS-RED for the activator and GFP for the inhibitor. And we were able to generate our transgenic lines. This is just a wild type Napoli-Stevens-I larvae here, no fluorescence in the eyes. And then our transgenic has fluorescence. You can see that the transgene is expressed in the transgenic mosquitoes and not in wild types, as you would expect. So we wanted to see when this was being expressed and where, if it was actually being expressed after the blood meal in the midgut. If you look at the bottom blot first, this is our transgene here. These smaller products are probably degradation products. But you can see it's very highly expressed in transgenic midguts. No expression in wild-type midguts. And more importantly, there's no expression in the carcasses of the transgenic mosquitoes. So it seems to be exquisitely midgut specific. And this is consistent with our cDNA and transcript work as well. We never saw anything in the carcass. It's only found in the midgut. However, what we did find is it doesn't appear to be blood meal specific. So even in non-blood fed mosquitoes, we have very high levels of expression occurring. So it pretty much seems to be expressed all the time in the midgut. This isn't necessarily a bad thing, except for the lifespan experiment that we set up before we knew these results, that I'm going to talk about in a second. But, you know, it's better that it's at least expressed all the time than just for a very narrow window of time. But it's something we have to keep in mind. So then the last thing we'll do is set up a lifespan experiment. This is a work in progress. We're up to 3 weeks right now. So it'll probably be about 2 months before this entire project's done. But we set up 4 treatment groups from the transgenic mosquitoes. One, we had transgenic mosquitoes that were blood-fed. We had wild-type mosquitoes that were blood-fed. And then we had transgenic mosquitoes that were only maintained on sugar. And then wild-type mosquitoes that were only maintained on sugar. The idea being that those transgenic mosquitoes only maintained on sugar should never have the transgene expressed and should be essentially equivalent to the wild-type mosquitoes. But of course, we know now that the transgene is always expressed, so that's not the case. I should also point out these are all siblings for each other. We maintain these lines as a heterozygous colony, and so when we have a mating and they ovipositate their eggs, half of the progeny are transgenic and half are essentially wild-type. So these mosquitoes are genetically identical except for insertion of the transgene. And so what we saw is, in fact, the transgenic blood-fed mosquitoes had much higher mortality than did the transgenic sugar-fed or the wild-type mosquitoes. But starting at about 4 weeks, we started seeing this marked decrease in the transgenic sugar-fed. And we weren't quite sure what's going on, but now that we have the immunoblots and know that, you know, we have this constant activation of the insulin signaling cascade leading to oxidative damage and other things, it's not surprising that we're having this die off now. So somehow we're going to have to figure out how to tell the difference between, you know, fitness costs due to the transgene versus fitness costs to activation of the insulin signaling cascade. But we have some ideas on how to figure that out. But it does seem like increased insulin signaling leads to a decrease in lifespan as we would expect. And then just to put some pictures to the names, Ben Fertile did the PI3 kinase work, Anam did the P10 work, Jessica and Frank are my technicians and they helped on both these projects, and then Laurel did the transgenic work at the end. So with that, I'm done. If anybody has any questions? Yeah?
This obviously is not my area, but I do have questions about you being a professor.
Okay, absolutely.
When you graduated, did you think you would become a faculty?
I was hoping to. You know, that was the ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, I knew the odds were long, but yeah, that was the primary goal when I started working at Susan's Lab. Well, I did my master's project in Susan's lab, and then I went to Georgia for my PhD and Johns Hopkins for a postdoc. And you know, really, it's just largely came down to the publications and getting good publications in high quality journals. Managed to, once the mosquito genome came out, we wrote a paper for Science, which helped a lot. so yeah, primarily it was, you know, just getting good pubs. All right, thank you.